Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a deadly conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Deadly, as in we are all born and then we die. Most people die and are buried or cremated without an investigation as to cause of death. But some deaths and all crimes are investigated. That includes suspected homicide, suicide, and drug deaths. All drug deaths are investigated, but not to the same national standard. We don't have such standards. There are differences in investigation depending on the resources of a community. Few areas of the United States have a medical examiner. A medical examiner is a doctor, like me, who went to medical school, and then instead of studying emergency medicine or pediatrics, studied pathology. A coroner, what most of the United States has, is an appointed or elected official, usually someone in law enforcement with no medical background. Both the medical examiner and coroners are charged with signing the death certificate and assigning a cause of death. Death investigations also vary by the law enforcement teams that attend a scene. I am very proud of our San Diego Team 10 that investigates every fentanyl death as a potential murder. That may sound extreme, but parents across the United States who lost loved ones to fentanyl have so many unanswered questions. Adding insult to their injury and their pain, many feel that no one cared or investigated their loved one's death. It was just another overdose. In San Diego, our team does their best to get answers to families as they go upstream to the supply of drugs that is poisoning America. Listeners know that I have been jealous of COVID, as well as gonorrhea, chlamydia, and salmonella diarrhea. Infectious diseases get contact tracing, mapping, and successful public health formulas to prevent further disease spread. I've been wanting those same methodologies for fentanyl and drugs. A few years ago, I reached out to the team at New York City who had an overdose 360 project that sounded like my contact tracing dream. To learn more about deaths from drugs and potential contact tracing for overdoses or poisonings, I reached out to Dr. Jason Graham. Dr. Jason Graham is the chief medical examiner of New York City, the most populous city in the United States. The Big Apple is where pizza is a huge deal, where more than 800 languages are spoken, and where a record 3,000 people died of fentanyl. As medical examiner, Dr. Graham oversees all deaths and is part of a special public health and public safety partnership that does a type of contact tracing for drug deaths. To learn more about Dr. Jason Graham, check out the High Truth show notes. Dr. Jason Graham, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
And how exciting to have a medical examiner from New York City. I don't do that very well. But tell us, why did you become a medical examiner? You went to medical school like me, and you must have really liked anatomy lab.
Well, I did. And my New York accent is certainly no better than yours. I'm a native Southerner, in fact. And so I grew up in Tennessee, and I still have a bit of that of a lingering Southern accent, if you can't tell. So I, unlike many who go into this specialty, which is a very rare specialty amongst all the medical specialties out there, Most of the medical examiners, forensic pathologists, that's our medical specialty. Most of the practicing forensic pathologists went to medical school to do this. I did not. I started my career after medical school in surgery and had intended on a career in surgery. And I certainly did love anatomy in medical school. That sort of fostered my interest in surgery as well. And then I went into surgery and found that while I enjoyed being in the operating room and doing procedures, the lifestyle of surgical residency and then the lifestyle of a surgeon was very difficult. And I didn't know that I would have that much longevity in that field. And so when I started looking in other directions, I had had an experience. First of all, I also loved pathology and histology in medical school as basic sciences. And I had an experience as a fourth year medical student in forensic pathology. I did a month's rotation at the medical examiner's office in Memphis, which is where I was in medical school at the University of Tennessee. And really, it sort of was a combination of the anatomy, the procedural components of performing autopsies, but also forensic medicine has the uniqueness of putting your medical knowledge to work solving crimes and interacting with an entire world of colleagues that you generally, as a clinical physician in the hospitals and in the clinics, are not exposed to and don't have the opportunity to interact with. And so when I began rethinking my career long term, I sort of recalled that experience as being very positive and being very interesting. And so I shifted to pathology. Before you go into the subspecialty of forensic pathology, you have to do the basic pathology residency. And most pathologists in the United States are practicing in the hospitals as surgical pathologists and laboratory medicine specialists, running the labs in the hospital and looking at biopsies and surgical specimens. And so I did a residency in pathology, and then as in the course of that residency was exposed further to forensic pathology as a subspecialty and really fell in love with that specialty because it really brought together all the elements of the components of surgery that I enjoyed, the added elements of our position and our role in the criminal justice system and in the public health system. The surrogate for dealing with patients directly for me came in the form of dealing directly with patients' families and being able to provide them with answers as to what happened to someone they care about who died suddenly or violently. And then, you know, the role with the courts and law enforcement and public health. And so it was really just sort of a combination of interests that I had that came together pretty coherently in forensic pathology. And so I finished my residency, did my forensic pathology fellowship. This was all in Atlanta at Emory University School of Medicine there. And then out of my fellowship, I did a year of fellowship in forensic pathology and then took a job directly out of training here in New York City in this office for Dr. Charles Hirsch, he hired me. He was the longtime chief medical examiner of New York, sort of an iconic figure in our field. And so I interviewed for the job. I was offered and accepted on the spot, came back home to Tennessee and told all my family I was moving to New York City. And aside from my immediate family, my extended family all had the same response, which is, I feel so sorry for you. They were scared of New York City, but yeah. They have since been visiting all the time. And it's been a wonderful 17 years now that I've been in this office. And
New York City, it's a magical, it is a magical place. We were there for a few days when I met you for the mayor's fentanyl summit. It was a beautiful day and it is just, it was gorgeous.
Yeah. I love the city. I love working here and it's like no place else.
Yeah. And so take us, by the way, how many years is that? Because you did surgery and pathology and forensic. So you were a resident for like a long time.
I just did a year of surgery. Okay. And so I did a surgical internship and then I did 3 years of pathology residency in anatomic pathology, and then I did a 1 year fellowship in forensic pathology. So 5 years.
That's
medical school. Yeah,
I mean, so it's a lot for most people. It's a lot, but I mean, in relative, you know, compared to like a neurosurgeon or whatever, it's doable.
Yeah, it's middle of the road in terms of the spectrum, I suppose, of postgraduate medical education. Yeah.
Right. I have a couple daughters going to anesthesia, so that's 4 years without the fellowship. So it'll be about the same. So take us behind the scenes. What is the life of a medical examiner? Is it as exciting as a you know, scene out of NCIS?
Well, I think that it's there are a lot of there's a lot of sort of I would say crossover, but certainly things are not as they appear on CSI. I can say that with certainty. Particularly getting, you know, test results in an hour and finishing up solving all the cases by the close of the episode. But it's there are, you know, this is a 24/7, 365 death investigation operation that you're a part of as a medical examiner. And we have when deaths occur in New York City, and our jurisdiction is the five boroughs of New York, you know, 8.5 million people, and all the visitors and tourists and people who commute into the city to work every day. And so when someone dies suddenly, unexpectedly, or violently in the city, it's our obligation to investigate those deaths. And so we do that through what we refer to as MLIs, or medical legal investigators, who go into the field. And anytime a death is involved, when you see police and fire department, EMS there, if there's a death involved, the medical examiner's office is also there. And so it's a 24/7 investigation operation that begins at the death scene. And then once our death scene investigation takes place on the part of our investigators, and one important thing to mention is that, you know, we occupy a special place in public service, and that is sort of at the crossroads between public health and public safety. We're not law enforcement. And for that reason, we have a certain investigative power. The families that we deal with will provide us with information that they may not tell a police officer, or even potentially an emergency room doctor, as yourself. And the poignance of the death often, brings about information that would otherwise not be known. And so we have a special relationship with the families. We're there from the beginning as a part of our death scene investigations. Once that takes place, the body is transported to our office here in New York City. We have three forensic pathology centers that serve the entirety of the city. We have offices in all five boroughs, but we have three forensic pathology centers where our doctors are stationed and perform autopsies. And so a person's body would be transported to us generally the next morning. An assessment would be made in each of these cases to determine whether or not an autopsy is needed. And if so, then an autopsy would be performed that day. And then the death certificate would be prepared, and the body would be prepared for release to the family for their final disposition. So and it is part of the autopsy. I guess this may be very basic, but if you'd like, I can just sort of describe what an autopsy is and how that process works. So our primary mission as forensic pathologists is to determine the cause of death and the manner of death. And so cause of death is either the disease or injury that produces the fatality, right? And in the case of drug overdoses, that's an intoxication due to the drugs that are involved in a combination most frequently. But the manner of death refers to the circumstances. Is it an accident? Is it a homicide, a suicide, or a natural death, a sudden, unexpected natural death? And so an autopsy is essentially a complete examination of someone's body after death. And that starts with a physical examination of the body on the outside, and looking for injury, identifying features, evidence of natural disease externally. And then we move to the internal examination, which is like a surgical procedure where incisions are made in the body and the internal structures of, including the brain, the structures of the neck, the chest, abdomen, pelvis are all examined, looking again for evidence of any injury and any natural disease. And as a part of that, we also take samples for testing in our laboratories, blood samples, tissue samples. In the case of drug overdose deaths, those are critically important for toxicology testing to determine what drugs may have been involved in this person's death. And I would also say that we never do autopsies in a vacuum. It's not like a laboratory test where you put a sample on an instrument and you get a result. It is the practice of medicine performing autopsies, and that autopsy is done in the context of a death scene investigation, clinical information, medical history, all of those components that go into formulating ultimately a diagnosis on the part of the medical examiner and forming an opinion about the cause and manner of death. And so it's a process in each one of these cases.
Thank you for sharing about autopsy. And I explained to our listeners kind of a brief difference between a medical examiner and a coroner. Actually, a huge difference after you saying all the training that you had as a doctor in forensics and pathology. But do you, in your practice and meeting with people across the country, see that difference in quality between what a medical examiner does and a coroner does? I don't think most Americans even know that there's a difference.
Yeah, I think that it is a little known difference, but it is a significant difference. And medical examiners just from the outset, medical examiners are appointed. They're qualified physicians, forensic pathologists, coroners. There are many coroner jurisdictions, usually in smaller counties. There are states that are entirely coroner, states that are entirely medical examiner, and then there's a mixture of coroner and medical examiner states. I think that, and there are, many, many, exceptional coroners out there. I think that the coroners, the basic difference, or one of the basic differences, is coroners generally are elected positions, and the qualifications for coroners across the country are varied. And so I think one commonality amongst all the jurisdictions, be it either a medical examiner system or a coroner system, is that they're all suffering from the strain of the overdose crisis, and they're having to deal with, enormous numbers of drug overdose deaths, and it's certainly a stress to the system either way, medical examiner or coroner. The medical examiner's offices are generally situated in larger cities, and many coroner jurisdictions transport their decedents, deaths that occur in their jurisdiction, to a regional medical examiner's office, for example, to have a forensic autopsy. So there is an interplay between medical examiner and coroner systems, but there are, fundamental differences.
Yeah. And how does the job affect you? I mean, you're dealing with horrendous crimes, people who die. Does that take an emotional toll, or is there a way of dealing with it? I guess you could ask me the same thing as an emergency physician. But if I'm working, then I'm not affected. I'm like doing my job, and it doesn't, I'm on task.
I can certainly relate to that. And you're right. This is very somber and difficult work. And certainly an enormous amount of potential exists for vicarious trauma when you're dealing with violent death every day. And that doesn't just apply to our doctors. It applies to, really across the spectrum of our workforce, our death investigators who are at death scenes, our staff who interact directly with grieving families. And I would say, as with it, in medicine in general, historically, we've probably been pretty bad at taking care of ourselves and recognizing the need for really self-care and caring for each other. And the mental health stress and strain that comes with the seriousness of our work, and certainly your work in the emergency room with life and death situations continuously, it takes a toll. We here in our office have really began to focus on this several years ago, and we began to develop a very robust wellness program to acknowledge these types of stresses and to teach our staff to recognize the forms of stress and recognize that in themselves and in others, and to try and produce programmatically ways of alleviating some of that stress and supporting each other. And so, you know, we've developed, we have a wellness committee, and we've began really to focus on wellness and develop structured programming around that to take the time and to, you know, commit to taking better care of ourselves and our colleagues doing this serious work every day. And especially, wow, you know, in the wake of the pandemic, you know, the pandemic was the largest mass fatality incident in modern history. And we were uniquely affected by that in many ways in New York, and it certainly took a toll.
That is true, right? I remember seeing pictures of, like, you know, your morgues were full.
Yes, it was a very difficult time. New York was hit first, and it became the epicenter of COVID in the United States. And we, at the peak of the first wave of the COVID pandemic, we were dealing with, you know, 250 or more deaths a day in the field, in addition to all of the fatalities that were happening in the hospitals. And so we, as the city medical examiner's office with responsibility as the city's mortuary, were responsible for managing those fatalities. And it was an all hands on deck approach, and, you know, even including bringing in active duty military. So it was an enormously challenging time, but I think that we really performed an enormous service for the city during that time, in a time when the funeral industry was shut down, at a time when families were ill and unable to make final arrangements. And so we shouldered that load, and I think did the best possible for the families during that time.
Wow, that's amazing. I think people already forgot about that, but I haven't. New York City, like you said, 8 million people, you are bigger than most states in the United States. As a matter of fact, when I look at fentanyl deaths by state, we kind of include New York City as its own entity, because you're so large. And I really wanted to reach out to you and have this conversation to learn about the innovations that you guys are doing in terms of outreach from the medical examiner in investigating deaths, specifically as they relate to drugs. And a couple of years ago, my team in San Diego reached out to you in New York to really learn and copy some of that. So if you don't mind sharing.
Sure. I feel like that New York City is really taking an all hands on deck sort of approach in many different arenas to address the, you know, the fentanyl crisis, the opioid overdose crisis. We at the medical examiner's office, I feel like, have gone beyond the traditional role of the medical examiner in terms of our outreach efforts. We have in drug overdose deaths, we have brought on a team of social workers who are, and data analysts, epidemiologists, to both obtain more information about these deaths and also to care more and have greater reach into the social networks and families who have lost someone to drug overdose. And so I think we've built what we refer to. It started off in a very small pilot form. We refer to it as our Drug Intelligence and Intervention Group, or the DIG, as we refer to it internally. And as a part of that, we've built now a team of social workers who reach out into the families, into the social networks around drug overdose deaths. And first of all, let them know that, and this happens after the initial death investigation. So the death occurs, we perform our death scene investigation, we perform the autopsy, and then after that, our DIG team, our social workers from the DIG team would reach out to the family who's lost someone and see how they're doing and try and make sure that if there are needs that they have, that we in some way help meet that need, connect them through a warm handoff to, if it's substance use treatment or if it's, you know, housing instability or any range of social service needs that they may have, we're trying to go farther to, again, to your point about going upstream and doing primary prevention, I think that that's a component of what the interaction with these families entails. Aside from meeting immediate needs, also, you know, looking at preventing future drug overdoses amongst other family members, et cetera. And in doing that outreach work, which even if a family isn't receptive to, you know, going into, if there's a substance use problem, going into treatment, if a person's not receptive, if they don't want to talk, just the act of reaching out, making that call and saying somebody in the city itself, and we as representatives of the city care about what happened to you. And we're sorry that this impacted you in your life, and that, you know, we want to try to do what we can to help you. And so just the act of making that call and reaching out has been, I think, certainly well received and meaningful to the families that we deal with. So aside from the outreach and connection to care and services, another part of our DIG team work is around data. And the DIG team really was formed out of a need for more and better data that is needed by all the partner stakeholders around the table on the public health side and the public safety side. And so we developed what we were referring to as a 360 degree outreach, a 360 degree investigation, really. These are really extensions of our primary death investigation. And it was looking at a person who had died of a drug overdose in a 360 degree way from the beginning of their life until their death. And it focuses on the entirety of their life, not just the events of their death. And it sort of recenters them in the entire narrative of their life. And it has and this 360 outreach investigation really contains so much rich information about how we might have done better for this person as a community, as a city, identifies gaps that need to be either, you know, closed through policy changes or programmatic adjustments. And so that's become a real centerpiece. This 360 degree outreach investigation has become a real centerpiece for our overdose fatality review process in New York City. And
One of the things I've talked about even before COVID was the whole concept of contact tracing. Like if we have a bad batch of salmonella, right, then we go after it, we contact trace, we extract that bad batch of lettuce, and we do that so much for infectious diseases, you know, sexually transmitted diseases, other infections. You know, when monkeypox came out, we were doing all these things and successfully managed the whole monkeypox, and yet it seems like we don't have the same approach to drugs, and I feel like that principle can match. And I don't know, it's not probably exactly correct, but what you potentially are doing is contact tracing. You have a death, you're going out to the family, and you're finding other people who are at risk, and you could make an intervention.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And I mean, I think that one unique element of this work that we've discovered is that I mentioned the uniqueness of our role as medical examiners being at the crossroads of public health and public safety. We found that we have exclusive access to this population. And it's a population that not only has special needs, but it's a population. And I'm talking about the families and the social networks surrounding drug overdose deaths. We're finding that we generally have exclusive access to that population, and no one else is accessing. They're not being, the police are on the scene at the moment, and then they have their role, and then they go on with their work. And same way, if someone goes to the emergency room, the problem is taken care of, and then hopefully, you know, that they get follow up if they need it. But we're finding in the families that we're talking to, we're really the only ones that are reaching out and accessing this population. And so The population on the whole has an enormous amount of rich data, at the least, that would be useful to the entire group of stakeholders around the table trying to fight this crap.
And I find data, it's not just for data's sake. It's like you can prescribe remedies based on that information. And the way I even got to this whole field of overdoses is when the medical community was overprescribing opioids, and doctors would say, you know, if patients just took their medicines like they were told, they wouldn't die. So I reached out to our medical examiner to find that out, and I looked at every single person who died of a medication and compared it to 12 months of prescriptions before they died, and created, you know, safe prescribing guidelines based on that data. So that data tells us which way to go. And I'm wondering if the data that you're collecting gives you some of that insights. For example, you would think this many years into our fentanyl problem, we would know what percentage of people who died of fentanyl intended, they have an opiate use disorder and they intended to use fentanyl, and what percentage of them were like, no, I just took a Xanax pill. I'm not addicted to opioids. I see that in the emergency department. I feel a failure on our end that we don't have that data yet. I'm wondering, it's a lot harder for you actually to get that data than for me. But do you have any insights to that?
Yes. I mean, this is a common question that we're presented with in terms of, you know, and you're right. It's you have the luxury of being able to ask your patient, you know, did what happened and what did you think you were taking? We clearly don't have that luxury in dealing with fatalities. We're left to glean what we can on that question from our death scene investigation and from talking to witnesses, talking to people who knew the decedent. And so it's very difficult often for us to be able to say with certainty what the decedent may have been seeking in terms of their drug use, if they wanted fentanyl only, or if they were just, as you said, looking for a Xanax and got a counterfeit pill that was full of fentanyl, which is, you know, every day's business nowadays in terms of counterfeit pills being on the street, I'm saying. Yeah. And so we, at the end of our process, have a toxicology report. We've tested blood samples from the autopsy, and we know what's in the person's system and what their cause of death specifically has been. But exactly the circumstances of their substance use in that fatal overdose is difficult for us.
Right. And so what have you learned from, you've been doing this 360 view, you know, death investigations now, especially for fentanyl for a while. What are there any teaching points that we can get from the data that you've collected? Like, we could have done something earlier, or for every person who dies, there's two other people at risk, or anything like that?
Well, I mean, I think that there are, there've been many, I think, good lessons that have been learned through our overdose fatality review process. I think, you know, one example that has happened here in that has been sort of a collaborative approach that came from examining from the overdose fatality review process was the work that's been going on by our Department of Homeless Services. There was a recognized need around fatalities occurring in shelters. And so as a part of that conversation, it became obvious that there needed to be Narcan and training on the use of Narcan across all of our homeless shelters. And so that happened as a result of looking at who is dying, where they're dying, and looking at the details of these fatalities. That's now widespread across New York City in our shelters, and to the great credit of the Department of Homeless Services. And so those types of really impactful sort of changes have come about through looking in depth at the fatalities and
that's huge.
Yes, it's and I think that's the type of when you look critically and do essentially a root cause analysis in looking at these fatalities, you identify those gaps that exist that have the potential to save lives. And one thing I always say when I get the chance is that, you know, we as medical examiners, there's nothing that we do that's for the dead, other than perhaps provide a burial on occasion. And everything we do is for the living. And it's whether it be in the criminal justice system to either get someone who's dangerous off the street or help exonerate someone who's been accused of a crime, or on the public health side, we are actively looking for the life-saving potential in our work. And that's a point that I want to try to always stress.
And you know what? I live that, because I think the person who helps make me a better doctor is law enforcement and the medical examiner, because I learn from those lessons and they immediately apply to my job as an emergency physician. And I think, as we've said before, is upstream as well. I was really struck by the number of, I don't know if the word is unhoused, but the homeless population, that sheltered population in New York City, it's a cold place. So I think it was like 80,000 people live in shelters. And what I learned is in fact, all those 80,000 people who are living in shelters in New York City are living in a safe consumption site, because all those, you're doing naloxone rescues in these shelters on a regular basis.
Yeah, I certainly would not want to speak for the Department of Homeless Services, but I think that they have made enormous progress, and it's really a success on their part.
How expensive is this program? Does it pay off? Like, what is the financial case of doing that? Because this is something that we have a crisis team after someone dies that invests, but investing in social workers after someone died, I don't think most people have that.
We are it's probably a little early to say. We're collecting data on all of the our social workers, you know, they reach out, they make primary referrals, and then from that, we also get secondary and then tertiary referrals. So we're in the process of providing data or collecting data and evaluating it on essentially how much care, what is the outcome from all of this work. I mean, there's some of the outcomes that are really, you can measure it, but it's the contact with the family that I mentioned, right? So there's that component. So we've reached out to this many families over this period of time. Right. Then beyond that, how many families how many individuals have accepted care of this type or the other? Is it substance use treatment? Is it mental health support? Is it grief and bereavement counseling? What types of care do they receive? And then the primary person then referring us to a secondary and potentially a tertiary level referral. We're in the process of looking at data on that, and we actually just got fully staffed this past summer with our social work team. We were in a very small scale pilot form really up until then, and with some of the opioid settlement dollars, that funding helped make this possible, the DIG team possible with the social workers. So I think we're still looking in terms of like the cost. I don't know if necessarily the cost benefit. It's a matter of just looking at how effective they've been at getting people into care. So it's probably a little early for me to be able to say. A year from now, I would hope to have some hard numbers around that.
And the last time we talked to you and asked you, it was like about 100 people a year. Is it still that, or you've gone up from that?
You mean that
100 like deaths a year that were involved in this?
Oh no, yeah, we will have I would say probably from September to the end of this quarter, we will have during that period of time reached out to at least 1,000.
So. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we were, when I spoke with you at that time, originally it was, we really only had one social worker.
Yeah. And it was a pilot.
And it was a pilot. Now we have you know, a team of 14 people. The majority of them are social workers. Then we also have epidemiologists and data analysts. And so smaller fraction of the team, but they're really, you know, the efforts have really ramped up. And so we will, you know, probably be looking at, you know, between September and end of March, we'll have reached at least 1,000 people, if not more than that.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah. Very really exciting. Bad. It's very exciting. And really. I, one of the other things that I didn't say, but I should have or could have, was that, you know, I believe that this is, in terms of medical examiner work, this really is just a proof of concept that I want to expand to all types of medical examiner cases, not just suspected drug overdose deaths.
Yeah. Right.
Talking about suicides, you know, other types of accidental deaths, maternal mortality, child deaths, suicides. I mean, look at the impact, the mental health impacts of suicides on families is just enormous. And so this is really just taking it to the next level in terms of caring for my patients are no longer alive. I have their families to help care for. And this is what we this is to me the next level of care that medical examiners can provide.
Yeah. I want to talk a little different. I mean, New York City is probably one of the most diverse places in our country. I unfortunately had the sad opportunity of reaching out to your ME office a couple years ago from Rabbi's wife's nephew who passed away in the Hasidic community of Borough Park, right? And I thought, who dies of overdoses there? I didn't even know that because it's such a closed community that the word was, it was just an accidental death or maybe it was a suicide. And after, you know, the burial and everything, I like reached out and it's like, well, he was found in the bathroom. It's like, that doesn't sound like a suicide. And it turns out it was a fentanyl overdose. And I knew right away when they said, they found some blue pills. And I knew right away that that was M30s. And of course, yeah. People are embarrassed when something like that happens, so they scrubbed the scene. I reached out to the detectives, and I learned that there were 4 deaths that weekend, you know, and no one talked to each other, and a tremendous loss in prevention opportunity because it's so quiet. I'm wondering, that's just one community. You have so many different communities in New York City, and I was really shocked that, you know, no one's exempt. From doing this, how do you reach out or what have you learned from these different populations?
Well, it's absolutely true that no community has been spared. This has touched every sector of our population across socioeconomic strata and geographic strata. Really, no one has been spared. I think that we have in our, you know, we continue to reach out into each of these social, you know, circles around the deaths. And we do have through our Drug Intelligence and Intervention Group, our DIG team, every day, we are reviewing every case that is a possible overdose in the city that comes to the medical examiner's office. And when we identify clusters, either geographically or, you know, from the same emergency room or in whatever form, if there are red flag type situations, we know that essentially on day one, and we notify our public health and public safety partners so they can, you know, take that information and then put it immediately to use. If it's a criminal investigation that needs to take place, that goes forward. If it's a public health intervention that they need to go and do an assessment in a particular residential building, for example, where there are multiple fatalities, that sort of response capability comes through data sharing and recognizing, you know, certainly any multiple fatality event with more than one person dying on the scene. That is shared. And we had a series of cases that came from the same residential building in Brooklyn over the past several months. And so that was a set of cases that were, you know, clearly red flags that needed to be looked at carefully and see what can be done to try and, you know, prevent deaths there. And so it's about having, you know, trusted partnerships across the public health and public safety worlds, and they are very different worlds. But we've really, through the city's RxStat initiative, I think, made leaps and bounds in terms of working together and really forging public health and public safety partnerships here in the city. And we're still in the midst of a relentless crisis. But I would I can only imagine how much worse it may have been without the effort that's going into it.
Right. And do you have any way of, the death certificate says, like you said, the mechanism of death, and then the toxicology report has what it is. Do you have a sense of how many of the overdoses are pills versus powder, or, poisonings versus murder versus suicide? Do you have a sense of that? And kind of like the first question I asked you, how many of these, people thought they were taking a Xanax, and how many intentionally were addicting? Because it's a public health issue, because they're saying, oh, we have all these people who died of fentanyl. We need to provide treatment for all of them. But as an emergency physician, I have people wake up from naloxone and they don't meet criteria of opiate use disorder. Buprenorphine is not going to be the answer to them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, the vast majority of all of these, of the drug overdoses, and I'm talking about, unintentional drug overdoses. The vast majority of all the deaths are unintentional drug overdoses, and we classify those as accidents. I'm asked about the idea of, are there potentially occult suicides amongst the people who are overdosing? And I would say that if we are missing any of those types of situations, it's very rare, because we have we clearly see suicidal overdoses. They're generally not with illicit drugs, and we have the option, if we're uncertain about how to classify a death, if we really suspect this is a possible suicide, and our burden of proof to call something a suicide is very high. It's not just more likely than not. We have to have real, a degree of certainty to say that this is a suicide and establish intent that person intended to die when they did, at their own hand. And if we are uncertain about that, we have the ability to say undetermined as a manner of death. And so I really feel like, on the question of whether there's a large number of occult suicides that are being misclassified, I do not believe that is happening. Mm-hmm. I think that, the vast majority of all these cases are accidental, unintentional drug overdose deaths. And, we've exceeded 3,000 deaths in the city for each of the past couple of years.
Yeah. That's crazy. I feel like we're under attack. But there are a group of parents, and I don't know if you've met them, who really object to the word overdose. And I understand on your end, you have to follow. It's really CDC criteria that classifies these, and you're not going to be able to change that nomenclature as a medical examiner. But they object. They feel like their child did not overdose. Their child was poisoned. How do you respond to that?
Well, we do not state the word overdose on our death certificates in drug overdose deaths. Now, what happens downstream from that point, for example, in a typical case, let's just say someone who is using a combination of heroin and fentanyl, the cause of death statement would be acute intoxication due to the combined effects of heroin and fentanyl, or fentanyl and heroin. And the section of the death certificate that says how injury occurred, we have to describe that. We would generally say substance use. So the word overdose generally does not appear on our death certificates. As we issue the death certificates, we certify deaths that fall under our jurisdiction, and then the health department gets those death certificates, and that feeds into the vital statistics system locally and then nationally. And the coding by the nosologists happens downstream of the medical examiner's office. So the death certificates are received. They are then coded based on CDC guidance and others. And that may be where the objectionable term is coming along for the families. I have not had experience dealing with families who have been, had that particular issue, but it's more often an issue for us in suicide cases when suicide is very sensitive in some of the most difficult cases we deal with, and families often are concerned about suicide being on the death certificate, which can be a public document depending on your jurisdiction.
Yeah, and there's also a group of parents that call fentanyl deaths a drug-induced homicide. And they use the word homicide. And you could see, if you thought you were buying a Xanax and you didn't and you got a fentanyl, then you could see that that could be a type of murder. But recently, there was a one-year-old boy at a daycare, Nicholas Domicini, and his death was classified a homicide. And I don't know if you can talk about that, if that's an active case, but the word homicide was applied to a baby who died of fentanyl.
Right. Well, I wouldn't comment on a specific case, but I can just say generally that I understand their sentiment that it is, it was essentially in their minds, a crime that was perpetrated against their loved one that resulted in their death. But these are active drug intoxications that are occurring in people who are using substances. And whether or not homicide appears on the death certificate has no bearing and does not in any way limit the criminal justice system, the district attorneys and the police department from arresting someone and charging them with crimes based on their, being a purveyor of pills laced with fentanyl, for example. So the idea that the classification of the majority of these deaths as accidents rather than homicide, first of all, the intent, there's no intent that's is established. This is an unintentional and untoward overdose death, and so they're best classified as accidents. That in no way ties the hands of the legal officials, the law enforcement officials, in terms of prosecuting or doing anything to sort of adjudicate whatever crime may have been committed around a death. The instances where homicide is used in children who are placed in an environment with a fatal drug present that they are inadvertently exposed to, that is death at the hand of another, in the sense that this child was placed in the environment exposing them to a fatal drug. And so homicide for us is death at the hand of another. And in the cases of children, and the more that time passes and the more that we have fentanyl at such levels on the street, there will be children who are affected by this, and there have been in New York City. And each case is evaluated comprehensively based on the investigation, and then we make that judgment at the end of our process. But it's the element of fatal, hazardous environment that a child is placed in that changes that situation considerably.
Yeah, and you know what? We're seeing that on our end in emergency department visits in children under the age of 5 who test positive for fentanyl. And one thing that we learned is if there is a death of fentanyl and there's children in that household, those children need to be tested, even if they're asymptomatic, because they could test positive for fentanyl without symptoms, and that can make a difference. So that's something that we kind of learned. Our area, San Diego, and then there's places around the country now that are doing or starting to do what you guys have been doing now for a while in New York City with overdose fatality review. That's a common thing to do for pediatric deaths and suicides, but now doing it for fentanyl. What are your tips for communities who are starting to do this?
Yes, we've been very successful with our overdose fatality review process. And you're right, there are parallel fatality review processes here in the city. We have, you know, child fatality review, maternal morbidity and mortality review conducted by the health department. One thing that I think is really critical is for the cases that are under review, and it's not always possible to review every overdose death. We have 3,000 overdose deaths here. That's impossible. Some settings you may be able to review all of the cases, but I would say select cases that you're able to do a 360 degree comprehensive investigation and use those to as the subject of the fatality review committees. Another critical factor is have players at the table who are decision makers and who are capable themselves in their own agencies, in their own line of work around the crisis. Have those people at the table. If it's, you know, your local health commissioner and your medical examiner and the chief of police or deputy chief of police, have executive level staff at, you know, essentially at the table to go back to their agency and put in place the policy or change the program that is identified as a problem during the fatality review process. So I think there needs to be a level of seriousness and commitment on the part of each of the agencies to the extent that they have a decision maker at the table. It doesn't have to be the head of the agency necessarily, but yeah, I know that's impossible generally, but someone with appropriate, you know, authority and influence in their sphere to be able to go back and put into practice what's discussed and revealed as a part of the overdose fatality review process.
Wow, that's a good tip. I want to talk about other drugs. Fentanyl, you know, is a driver of death, but there's other things that we're seeing, xylazines, nitazines. Are there any trends that you're seeing in New York?
Well, fentanyl far and away is driving, the fatalities, the number of fatalities, and it's generally fentanyl in combination with multiple other drugs. It started off, fentanyl with heroin, and then we saw the emergence of the fentanyl analogs, which have largely disappeared. We're now, it's essentially pure fentanyl with combinations of other drugs. Cocaine has sort of surged onto the scene as, being the source of deaths, combination of cocaine and fentanyl, and other drugs as well. Xylazine, we have seen xylazine. Xylazine is in roughly up to about 20% of our cases. We have not seen as much in the way of xylazine as other jurisdictions, but it's certainly present in New York City. I think that we have seen the resurgence of or the combination of cocaine and fentanyl has grown. And actually that's outstripped the combination of fentanyl with heroin now. So we have essentially more cocaine with fentanyl than we do fentanyl with heroin. Fentanyl's really never seen alone. It's always in combination with other drugs, essentially. And likewise, we've not seen a pure xylazine overdose. It's xylazine in combination with fentanyl and other types of drugs. And so it's a constantly evolving scene, and our toxicology lab has to, continue to do comprehensive testing to be able to identify something new as it emerges on the scene. One thing that everyone is really fearful of is carfentanil, right? Fentanyl is enormously dangerous. Carfentanil is beyond dangerous.
Right. 100 times more.
It is another universe of, right. of danger. And we fortunately have not seen, we have had cases of carfentanil intoxication here, but we have been relatively spared as compared to other areas of the country in the Midwest and Ohio, for example. And so we are constantly on the lookout for that. And we have had a few cases, but luckily we've been largely spared carfentanil, and I hope it stays that way.
Yeah, and methamphetamine, not as much on the East Coast as it's hitting us on the West Coast.
Yeah, I understand, and this is not my area, but I do understand that there have been more seizures of larger amounts of methamphetamine in the New York City area. In terms of its involvement in deaths, we certainly see methamphetamine involved in drug combinations, but we have not seen a proportional increase in methamphetamine involvement in deaths as they may have seen in terms of the amount of methamphetamine that's been seized by law enforcement.
Right. But you know what? Just in the short little time that you were able to tell me like your trends and how they've changed, I see a public health intervention and it's the cocaine and fentanyl combination because people, like the other shift, I had a guy who needed naloxone, tested positive for fentanyl. He had no intention of using fentanyl. It's just cocaine. And if there's a population out there of people who intend to use cocaine, that's really where the fentanyl test strips and stuff really come in for and targeting the population who thinks they're using cocaine.
Yeah, absolutely. That is certainly a serious public health concern. People simply seeking cocaine and getting fentanyl. And the message is fentanyl is everywhere. Assume any drug you have or any drug you obtain contains fentanyl. Assume
that's right.
That is the only safe way to proceed, if there is a safe way at all.
Yeah. Now, when I told you that death diary study that I did with looking at everybody who died of a medication with the medical examiner, and I saw all sorts of drugs there. I mean, like estrogen, testosterone, like they tested for everything. But marijuana, THC wasn't there. And at the time, I asked, why isn't it there? And it's like, oh, well, nobody dies of marijuana. It's like, well, how would you know? So it took me several years, and we were able to get that data, extract it. Like my medical examiner says, it was like pulling teeth, but he got the data. And we saw, like, over the years, the number of deaths have gone up, and at the same time, that the THC-associated deaths have gone up as well. And we know that THC is additive with alcohol and every other drug. And yet there's some places that are just not testing for THC. I'm wondering if you are and if you're looking at any trends. A recent public autopsy that came out was of the actor Matthew Perry of Friends, and his medical examiner autopsy report said death by ketamine and confounding drug with Suboxone. So they tested Suboxone, a drug that we know is relatively safe. But the medical explained that, well, it's, you know, it adds along with ketamine. But so does that lorazepam he took, and so would marijuana if they tested for it, but nobody tested for it. I'm wondering if that's something I see inconsistent around forensic testings in different places.
Yes, there is a fair bit of inconsistency across jurisdictions in terms of, and going back also to medical examiner and coroner jurisdictions, there's a good bit of variability. And that is, you know, I think something to work toward greater consistency. I think that's certainly been one priority that the CDC has had in terms of the way that deaths are certified, how we fill out death certificates in order to provide them with the most and the best data. And ideally, the death certificate would state plainly the drugs that are directly mechanistically contributing to one's death. And, rarely is one drug in a combination of drugs the antidote to another of the drugs. And generally, most all the drugs that are involved mechanistically contribute. And it's our practice to list specifically on the death certificate each of the drugs that contribute to death. And in terms of marijuana, we do routinely in our cases test for cannabinoids, the base compound in marijuana, and so we know whether cannabinoids are present or not. The mechanistic contribution of cannabinoids in the setting of fentanyl and cocaine, you could look at that and say, well, the effect of the cannabinoids may be negligible in the setting of someone who's acutely intoxicated with cocaine and fentanyl. But we at least have that information to make a decision around, because we test for it routinely in all of our cases. And so we have our toxicology report and we know whether it's present or not.
Right. But when I looked at that data, it gave me a lot of questions like, wait, how come young people are dying just THC, like just THC in the system, you know, from an asthma attack, you know, how, you know, that you could see that correlation or the cardiac, there's a huge cardiac etiology. And also the THC that's out there can be 90%. It's not just, you know, the Cheech and Chong marijuana that's out there. If we are systematically ignoring this data and not looking at it, then how are we going to detect a problem and account for it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we part of it may be, limited resources in some jurisdictions. I wouldn't want to speak for anybody else in terms of their testing practices. We routinely test for cannabinoids, so we have that information in our cases to make a judgment around as to whether or not it contributed or not, but at least we have the information. We generally do not quantitate the cannabinoids, but we, on occasion, given a set of circumstances like you described, a young, otherwise healthy person, that we have this is the only drug and no cause of death, we would potentially quantitate and go do additional testing steps to try and go as far as we can to determine the cause of death. So it's very case specific, but just as a class of drugs, we certainly routinely test for cannabinoids.
That's involved there. It kind of reminds me of the tobacco era where people were saying, well, these lungs are black. That's not because of tobacco. And I've seen on several death certificates, there's a little box and it says, tobacco use, yes or no. And
right.
And I don't know if that's universal everywhere, but I've noticed that little box, and it's like there at some point there had to be a case to account for that, for that tobacco use with deaths.
Yeah, that's pretty well universal. It was it was added as an epidemiologic tool to the death certificate as to whether smoking contributed to the death. Yes, no, or unknown, basically. And so
right.
We have to choose that.
Yeah, I would add vaping now, right?
Yeah.
Right. So thank you so much. In conclusion, what advice do you have for live people? Like you said, everything you do is for people who are alive based on what you learn and see as a medical examiner.
Well, I think I would just reiterate what we discussed around safety in terms of the drug supply. There is no safe drug supply at this moment in time. The assumption is that if it's obtained, if you obtain a drug on the street, it has fentanyl in it. And that is, I think you need to be aware of that and need to know that the risks that are involved. And if you're going to use drugs, you need to do as much as you can to prevent harming yourself with the awareness that fentanyl is in everything, and it is enormously dangerous.
Yeah, and we could end now with the upstream, downstream. You're about as downstream as it gets, but it's kind of game over by the time they're your patient. I get one last opportunity when they're my patient, kind of going upstream from you, but hopefully, what I'd like to see as a nation is going even more upstream in preventing so people don't become my patient or your patient in the first place. And Dr. Jason Graham, Medical Examiner of New York City, so much to learn from you. Thank you so much for sharing. I really appreciate it. And New York is fortunate for having you, not for the people who died, but for the people who are going to be living.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Levitt. It's been a pleasure, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.